duties, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Fireside Chats.
Hey, 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 Fireside Chatters. Welcome back to another hour of speculation and education from San Diego, drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke, getting my gears lubricated for the journey ahead. I'm Greg Carlwood. I'm happy to say my good friend and occasional co-host Kyle Prineville is here for this one. I've often said that throughout our nearly 20-year friendship, I'm usually the loudest voice, but Kyle has always been the soundest, which is a dynamic that comically manifests itself in the routine voluming issues we have on THC. But Kyle, my man, how's it going?
It's going well. I really like what you said there, Ed. Thank you, man.
No problem, dude. What's been going on with you, man? What's on your mind? What's new?
Very rarely follow any kind of politics. It's such a sideshow. So
fair.
One thing that happened was a lot of people in my Facebook feed are celebrating this woman in Texas, the senator who gave somewhere between 10 and 13 hour filibuster to this bill that was almost surely going to pass in Texas that would essentially ban abortions.
They're still trying to do that.
Well, that is essentially gay marriage and abortion. Maybe this is just me, but these are topics they just pull back out every so often to just totally divert you from banks, bombs, killing Iraqis, all this kind of stuff. So they want you to focus on these sideline issues anyways. The filibuster is the most ridiculous part of the democracy that we accept. And it's a democracy where the young people can't really participate. When you're voting, you're not really participating. You don't actually get to vote. It's not on the internet. It's not a poll or anything like this. It is these senators, and they play by these game rules where if you just sit there and talk for 13 straight hours, then they can't get around to the vote, and so then they just can't pass the bill. And that is what they call common sense democracy.
Yeah,
these are the most educated people, supposedly, most qualified, supposedly. And if they can just get up there and talk, say anything for 13 hours, that's all it takes.
Yeah, it seems like a system that 8-year-olds came up with.
It's hard to believe anyone accepts that this is the way it is, but in fact, nobody questions that filibusters and the whole democratic process is just totally false.
Yeah, I actually saw The Daily Show. They talked about the same exact filibuster situation, and they had all these rules, like you can't leave, you can't use the restroom, you can't stray from the topic, you can't lean on anything, and it's so silly to think that there was a time where there's guys sitting around coming up with the rules for a filibuster. Like, any of that time should be spent on something else.
It's a broken system, man. But everybody knows that. I got a question.
Hit me.
I got to ask you about a certain psychedelic.
I'd assume you mean dimethyltryptamine. We talked last time that I was going to do it, and I have now been initiated into the DMT community, you know, visited by our friend, the dimethyltryptophene himself, Fernando. Yeah, man, I feel like it was pretty cool. I did see the complex geometric patterns. I felt the warmth and vibration of the body associated with DMT, but I did not have an experience that I could extrapolate any meaning from. I didn't have a visual experience that had any type of recognizable symbol or any type of narrative of any type. And, you know, I wanted to get some kind of insight into myself or my path, which I had come to expect from hearing about DMT experiences. And that didn't really come. And that may be in part because this was the first DMT that Fernando had synthesized himself, which made me a little nervous. But it was also in a liquidy form, which is uncommon, apparently. It's usually more crystallized. And, you know, he put that on a bowl of weed, which I've also read there is a debate in the dimethyltryptamine community that marijuana might actually lessen the effects of DMT. So there's that factor, too, possibly. But it was definitely worth doing, and it was a positive experience. I feel like it would be a little hard to have a fully negative experience, because positivity involved in the warmth seems more there, more present than it does with mushrooms or any other psychedelic. But I mean, your experience, I think, is a lot more symbolic and meaningful and interesting.
Yeah, I've done it a couple times and had really good experiences and didn't know what to expect, really. I mean, after the first time you do it, then you kind of have somewhat of an expectation. You kind of know what it's going to be like a little bit. But even those ideas are like false. But I don't know. Like, my third trip was really similar to my first, and almost a similar, I don't know, it's hard to explain, but a similar type of space is where I felt like I was at. It's really a blending of all the senses, like feeling and sight and being the environment around you. And the very essence of where you are and what you're experiencing and who you are is all unspeakable. Like, it's you when you're in the experience, you know, you can't later explain what it's like.
Yeah.
And part of you goes into it feeling like, oh, man, I'm going to remember this. I'm going to see some crazy shit and then I'm going to talk about it. But then during it, twice I like laughed. I got to a point after the peak where just like rips you through bright colors and expanding imagery and stuff like this. And then I got to a point where I was trying to like come up with a story. I was trying to come up with like, what did I just see and what did I just experience? And then this presence was just like, come on, man, you can't put this into words. And then I would laugh out loud, like my semi tripped out body would just like giggle.
Damn.
Which is similar to a psilocybin experience, but with mushrooms, I feel like you cannot help but go into the trip. You can't really resist it. It really overwhelms you. Whereas with dimethyltryptamine, I feel like you're a voice inside your head that's thinking, talking, and taking notes. I think it can interfere a lot more.
Yes, I would say that's 100% true. I think I never lost that voice, and I was following it, you know, like, maybe it's the ego in the back of the head. It's like, all right, man, you can handle this. You can handle this. This isn't that bad. This isn't that intense. You know, we're still here. We're still conscious. We still gotcha. And then by the time that was getting difficult, I could tell I had peaked and I was coming back down. And I was like, oh, man, I never lost that voice. I almost spent the whole trip rationalizing that I was still with it, you know.
Yeah, and even with, like, other spiritual practice, such as, like, intentional meditation and trying, you know, consciously in your life to quiet your mind and quiet that racing, you know, thinking aspect of yourself, and just sometimes like just try to make that silent. It's really hard to do. Even with that kind of training going into DMT, it's still tough. I don't know if that means we're just not taking big enough doses or it's not potent enough, but I feel like it's tough.
I agree, man. I mean, I think the descriptions of what I expected it to be are probably closer to what would be gained from a full ayahuasca session. I mean, that is probably the final frontier. I think it's longer, more intense, a more personal journey, which, you know, I'm going to be a lot closer to attaining when I move to Chile, which is probably in my future. I mean, because what good is it to see a ship sinking if you don't get off? But it's quite scary when the ship is all you know.
Well, I was really psyched about that episode, too, and thinking a lot about not only Chile, but Mexico and a lot of places. Really fascinating what he was talking about.
I had to make a decision if I was going to have a capitalism debate, and I didn't want to do that, but I knew that if I challenged it, we would have that debate. So I was just like, okay, I think there's probably answers beyond capitalism and beyond a monetary system, and I don't think free markets are going to solve all our problems, but I still would, I'd rather just gain knowledge from you in terms of your travels and the political climate in different areas of the country. I thought he was very knowledgeable about that. And that's important information that I don't hear very often at all. So those unique experiences of traveling over 100 countries, that's unfathomable knowledge, I feel like. You're not going to get that from a book. You're not going to get that from school, unfortunately. And it's important. You know, the planet's round. We should know what's going on all over the place. And I envy his amount of knowledge.
People all over are being introduced, and a lot of times through conversation, like through podcasts, you just hear someone's point of view and the kind of experiences that they've been through, and it just opens a doorway into a whole different world that you just had never even, I don't know, you just in your bubble, you never came in contact with any information like that, and all of a sudden you're just processing really new, really novel stuff. And this whole idea of like being a permanent traveler and not trying to pay taxes or have a residency in any particular place sounds like a dream. I guess I got to invent a software company or something first.
Or just pick up $200 and go to Cambodia.
Yeah, start a bar.
Man, I've been joking about that all week. It seems too good to be true. Of course, there's going to be some inconveniences with doing that. But Chile, I think it's right where I'd like to be in terms of there's growth potential, but it's also a place where I can get a good internet connection. And Galt's Gulch sounds like an interesting place. And a lot of Americans seem to be going there, which is also a little comforting. You know, you're going to be around people who speak your language, because that's a big concern, too. I don't speak any Spanish, so it's a little tough for me to take off and start a business where all my customers speak a different language.
Yeah, but you got to be open to the possibility, because he really had me reflecting about what it's like to feel the police and the feel the surveillance state everywhere you go, always being watched, always being, it all goes on your permanent record.
Something I was going to say about Jeff Berwick and his talk about police is, yes, I understand his point that it's kind of cool to be able to give the cops a couple bucks and go on your way. But that's from the perspective of a rich man. Yeah, a rich man's going to be disappointed when he can't just give an American cop $100 and get out of those cuffs. But it's tough to know if that's something I would rather have. If you're getting harassed for no reason and shaken down for $20, I mean, that's not an ideal situation either. But maybe it's better if you can bribe your way out of trouble.
I think basically what he's suggesting is that you can bribe your way out of trouble for cheaper, because in the States you'd have to hire an attorney, and then the attorney does whatever voodoo that they do, and it gets rid of your charges.
Good point.
It's a very similar thing. You're just paying a different guy money.
Right. I guess it's just a matter of having the money on you rather than getting a ticket, which is essentially a bill for 30 days from now. So I don't know, but yes, Santos has some pretty interesting information. I'm hoping that we can start the conversation talking about how, because he comes from the perspective that Rome is the architect of all our problems. And I'd like to get started off with talking about the false reality that they've constructed around us that we keep busy with and keep distracted with. And it really keeps us enslaved consciously, and then transition into why they built this. They built this specifically, in Santo's view, to cover up the true reality, which if we knew that, if we knew the real secret science, we would be more empowered and be on a path to enlightenment, or what the Bible calls ascension, which is what he would probably say is just the activation of the pineal gland and the ascension of your consciousness, rather than a physical being ascending to a place called heaven. I know you're way more into this topic than I am, the mythology, the mysticism, the astrology. You get a lot more out of that than I do. It resonates with you a lot more than it does me. That's why I'm glad you're here on this conversation. I think you face a bit of resistance when you make those type of statements online when I see it. But you do a pretty good job of handling it and bringing it back to you do a pretty good job of bringing people around, I think, to at least entertaining the concept.
Yeah, I mean, the whole point is to try to say things that are true, whether or not, you know, they are objectively true for everybody and really scientific and repeatable. I feel like with your own insight, I feel like there's like spiritual tools, you know, and a lot of like Buddhist texts talk about the same things, like the power of focused concentration, the power of mindfulness, and how just contemplation can be like a almost like an extrasensory form of perception, like just thinking about events in your life or thinking about choices that you made or thinking about coincidences, the way they lined up. You can like, I don't know, it feels like you can find truth, like true statements pop out of it. And that's part of like meaning generation and like, I don't know, making the mundane things seem really insightful.
Yeah, I'm open to that idea, and I love to play with it in my own life, finding synchronicities, finding coincidences, developing a meaning from them. But it's almost just like a pastime or a thought exercise. I don't actually. There's some disconnect with me where I don't believe it. I don't believe I do it. I pay attention to it and I feel open to it, but I felt no effect. I felt no effect from Reiki. I felt no effect from meditation. I felt no effect from crystals or gemstones. And, you know, I feel like I've given it a fair shake and it just doesn't do it for me.
I feel like with coincidences and the sequence of events in your life, that has, like, the gateway for me is really recognizing that you are also your environment. You're your body, but you're also the environment the body is in. And Santos gets into this. It's kind of like the idea that this is all one process, I think is what they were trying to say with the Tao, that we're all in this together. We use words to distinguish what we are, and we use our bodies to kind of like identify with a certain time and place. And you're trained your whole life, I feel like, the mythology of Catholicism. And not only that, but also with school and the state and everything, you're treated like a little robot with a manufacturing date, and you just, I don't know, decay over time, and your parts wear out and they're just replaceable. And all of this idea is to drive the idea home that you are some little object and you're not the whole experience. Like some people say you're part of everything, or like, you know, without me, the whole rest of the universe wouldn't exist. But Alan Watts used a term which is goes with. It's like you go with the sun, you go with Saturn and Mars and Mercury. All these things have always existed simultaneously with human life, and therefore human life goes with them. They are all part of the same process, so their individual meanings start to become like, once you dig into what that could mean and what, yeah, I don't know, like it even goes back to sacred G, like what different numbers mean, what the number two represents, like duality and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. It is weird, but I do like that Alan Watts explanation of everything's connected is, you know, he says, you know, you are God, you are the universe. Well, they'll be like, oh, well, if I'm God, then how do I shine the sun? He's like, well, the same way you beat your heart, the same way you work your thyroid gland, you know, it's all the same thing. You are doing it subconsciously. The whole universe is manifesting itself and breathing in its own way and rotating and spinning and doing all the things that the universe does. And it just does it. There isn't a conscious thought behind it. And that's the same way that you control your liver, you process food. You know, all these things that your body's doing while you're going about your 9-to-5. And that's some powerful shit, man. It's keeping you alive. And you're doing it always and never paying any attention to it. And it's the same with the way the universe is doing its goings on. And apparently, you know, it's all part of one thing. And I feel like that's a pretty decent explanation. Or a good thought.
That's a great thought.
Yeah, Alan Watts is a badass, man. Love listening to that guy. I actually sent Fernando home with probably 15 CDs worth of Watts lectures. That's got to be 30 hours, maybe more.
He has to be my favorite lecturer probably of all time. I just love his diction, the way his voice sounds, and you know, how clever and lighthearted he is when he gives his talks. I was just reading his last book, The Watercourse Way. He was in the process of writing it, and it had to be finished by one of his friends and fellow students. But it's really interesting. I love this whole concept of Taoism. It's like the one eternal flow. He calls it the watercourse way because that's his best description of it. It's just a flow like water. It's never the same. It's always changing. It's always moving. And that underlying now, the now that always keeps getting refreshed and is always slightly different than the previous now, that thing, that process that just keeps on going, he calls it, you know, the Tao. And It's similar to the whole thing with DMT. It's, I feel like that's what you get in touch with, is the eternal, unspeakable, you know, all patterns come from it, but it's impossible to contextualize. It's impossible to put into words. It's impossible to put into symbols. All symbols come from it.
That was a thought that I did have, that internal, that voice that's in the back of your head, that's holding on during the journey. I did have the thought when I was seeing some crazy visuals, my mind was saying to me, okay, now you're seeing everything that's ever happened at one moment. You're seeing everything that's ever existed in three-dimensional space, you know, within your peripherals. You know, you're seeing everything. You know, that's what it was. It was just craziness.
Yeah, it's, you just, you delve into those deep waters, you get wet, and then you just come back and you're like, what the hell happened?
It's a wild thing, and I'd have to do it way more to feel like I could talk about it in any kind of educated way. It was just such an off-putting experience, such a foreign experience, but a positive one nonetheless. All right, well, it looks like today's guest is almost ready. His name is Santos Bonacci. He's talking to us from Melbourne, Australia. Funny thing, man, Conspiracies have actually been doing really well in Australia. It's like every fifth shirt I ship is to Australia. And I feel bad because the shipping cost is so high. It's like $9.95 flat on the site for international shipping. But to ship to Australia, it's actually like $13, but I don't mind making up the difference. But damn, even paying $10 to ship a $20 shirt is pretty rough. And I appreciate that people like them enough to put up with that shit. I apologize on behalf of the international parcel delivery infrastructure. It's a piece of shit, but thanks to those people. I did also want to mention this on the subject of Australian conspiracies purchasers. I just got this email from this guy named Stuart. He bought the Quit Your Job tee, which is an image of a man, or for the full effect, it's supposed to be a homeless man holding the typical cardboard sign. But instead of begging for anything, it says quit your job. It's one of my favorite shirts. It's a fuck you to the system, or to align with the theme that our guest Santos speaks about often. It's a call for peaceful non-compliance to the system. But anyway, I always throw in some conspiracies business cards with the shirts. I throw them in there. And this guy, Stuart, wrote me this email. Says, thanks, Greg. I distributed your cards to all my colleagues at work. The next day, I quit my job. Your work is having a positive impact. Best regards. Isn't that the shit, man? That is some powerful shit. Stuart in Australia, thanks for being a fan of the show and for buying some shirts. I'm envious of your courage and your freedom, really. You're a badass, man. Fuck.
Yeah, man, you're living the shirt.
Yeah, very awesome. I almost forgot to mention that. I also need to mention that THC is getting a little help from a guy who runs an awesome comic company called Mind Comics. So we want to give him a little help as well. If you like the themes we talk about on THC, you really should check out mindcomics.com. They focus on stories that evolve from conspiracy theories, science fiction, travels into the multiverse through psychedelic exploration. I mean, that is what we're talking about today. They have a series called Psychonauts, one called Corporate Tunes, which looks right up my alley. The latest thing they have out, the one I have read, is called Off Grid. It's a story of a civil war between a technocratic enslaving government and a resistance group of ex-military and anonymous hackers fighting for survival off-grid. It's got amazing illustrations by my man known as Plaid Klaus. So treat yourself to a fun exploration of the outer reaches of the mind. And check out mindcomics.com. They're pretty damn good comics. You can also find them on the Higher Side Chats website. They're off on the sidebar. Have you seen them at all, Kyle?
I don't know, but I'm going to check them out.
Yeah, you haven't lived. So tomorrow you might start your life by going to mindcomics.com. If anybody is trying to get a creative project off the ground or has like a small business they've started to try to buy back their freedom like I'm doing, I am always open to advertisements, partnerships, sponsorships, that kind of thing. Just email me at thehiresidechats@gmail.com. I have to be pretty selective because I don't want to fill up too much time with ads. But if you got something that can be mutually beneficial or fits with the themes, let's talk. I don't know. Okay. I guess I'm going to play the old conspiracies ad bullshit and sell some shirts that help keep the show going and growing. And we'll be talking to Santos Bonacci on the other side. Boom.
We're here because we don't buy into the bullshit of mainstream culture. We're tired of the mundane, passionless careers we've been shuffled into as a result of this orchestrated debt-based system of rule, and the stranglehold on education and entertainment by cold, soulless corporations. People, yes, we are frustrated. Yes, we are tired. And we reject the brave roof tranquilizers that are Monday Night Football and an ice-cold Budweiser. But we have to stop hiding. Stop hiding behind the headphones and the Cherry Popper 420 username. Let the world see that the resistance is strong and society is changing. There was a time to be anonymous, but that time has passed. And so the Higher Side Chats would like to present Conspiraties as the dawning of this new paradigm in the uniform of the revolution. Because bold fashion should mean more than some celebrity meat dress or frat boy in a silly pink polo. Conspiraties redefines bold fashion as having the balls to reject socially uncomfortable and unpopular truths from your radiant chest all fucking day. Conspiraties.net. Let them know that you know. Bold designs for troubled times. Hard truths. Soft talk.
Folks, it seems that there is an underlying code beneath many aspects of society and culture, including law, economics, and of course, religion. Now, many people go their whole life without questioning how this structure was built, although understanding that our situation is not a product of coincidence, but has been carefully orchestrated by the architects of society and culture is essential to revealing truth. And today we're going to explore that framework by examining the language, bureaucracy, and allegories that have been put before us to confuse and distract people from the true reality. And I can think of no better person to help us explore the lies in a lot of these areas and teach us about the truth that we've been denied than the man we have with us today. He's been studying the material for over 30 years, and he lays a lot of it out in his great presentations and lectures hosted on his website, universaltruthschool.com, all the way from Melbourne, Australia, Santos Bonacci. Santos, welcome to THC.
Thank you very much. Thank you kindly.
Absolutely, man. It's a real pleasure. I've been digesting your lectures for a while now. They're very engaging, cover a lot of material. There's a lot of things I hope we can touch on. Thought a good place to start is with this short little paragraph I found in the description of your Reclaiming Dominion lecture. I think it really summarizes the case I'd like to make in the first half of the show, which is the inventions from the kingdom of ideas that is Rome are the Gregorian calendar, the Latin language, capitalism, fictional Christianity, democracy, canon law, maritime law, phony money, and the corporation. All of the above are fictional creations of the elite families of the world through which Rome has subjugated and enslaved the whole inhabited earth. Wow, that is a powerful paragraph. Can you elaborate on some of that for us?
Yeah, well, Rome has been at it for a long time, in particular the elites. These families have amassed wealth and kept it in their family lines for a long, long time. That's the secret of their control over the rest of mankind. It's the wealth, you see. They can buy all the support they need. And these families actually got the coup of the century, last century in 1913, when they got their new charter. They had two previous charters in the United States, but this was the third charter of the private central bankers. And the families were all represented there, you know, the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers and the Morgans were all the Warburgs, the Schiffs, they were all there, and they chartered the Federal Reserve. And so through that, Rome has controlled the masses because it is a Jesuit organization. It's run by the Jesuits and by the Vatican. They run everything, really. They sort of they do everything behind the scenes. It's a shadowy cabal, this Roman elite world that we live under. And one thing that must be understood is it's not just the money component that controls mankind, and it's not the political and the positive law that comes from Rome, but the third branch would be the religious side of it. The ecclesiastical system is behind all of it. They run the courts, they run even the politics, because the politics, for instance, your local councils and everything like that, they all obey the parishes. It's not the other way around, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's so the land that we live on is parish and council, or you know, we could call that the political part of the aspect of the corporation. You see, I don't know what you have there in your country, but here we have councils, municipalities. You know, in America, there's boroughs, counties. The Jesuits have provinces, and they trump the political system. So it's all ecclesiastical. When you go to court, you're going to a bank, and the judge is an ordinary, which is an officer of the Inquisition. He has to his right or to his left, he will have a clerk, which is nothing other than a cleric. And that's the most powerful man in the court, by the way, the cleric, the clerk. And of course, the whole lot of it, I've exposed this in my presentations at length.
Mm-hmm.
How the whole thing is about paying indulgences. And the scriven and notaries are the ones who write the indulgences, because that's what scriven and notary means. It means a writer of indulgences. And so every summons and every piece of court document is actually, they are indulgences. So the Inquisition's still on, and it's all ecclesiastical. So the elites have got it down pat. They know how to control the masses. It's political, it's financial, and it's religious. And it's all run by Rome.
I mean, it's really fascinating. One thing I've heard you talk about before that I hope you can elaborate on is the truth behind the birth certificate. You know, I always thought it was a little silly that we needed it, but apparently there's an underlying meaning to why it exists.
Yeah, well, it's supposed to be a protection for the individual legally, but because the bank system has usurped the natural organic government, if there ever was such a thing. I mean, it's
right.
People do still believe that the first constitution of 1778 was really, really an authentic organic document to just not to establish the rights, because they are God-given, but to declare the rights of the individual. And so they think it was a fair organic document, whereas other researchers beg to differ. They suggest that it was, you know, just something for the elites to protect their wealth.
Mm-hmm.
But they made it appear to be a constitution and a Bill of Rights and Declaration of Independence and all of those, the Articles of Independence or and whatnot, which spawned the Republic. But see, what happened was there was the 1871 incident, and that's after 10 years of amending the Constitution and all sorts of things from 81 to 61 to 1871, that decade that Abraham Lincoln lived in. They defined the person, they redefined person, you see, and they gave corporations personhood. And then in 1871, of course, the act, they enacted the new government in D.C., you see, and that's the Vatican government. So in that decade, the Vatican came back to take its rightful place, because from their perspective, they were the ones that funded, the elite families funded all the first ships that came over and established colonies and companies and what have you. And so, therefore, they continue to see that as their property. That's why the New World was always considered to be the property of England or the property of France or of Holland, you know, or these conquering countries. But behind them all was the Vatican, because they had the so-called treaties, like the Treaty of Tordesillas. I hope I got that right. Yeah, Tordesillas. I usually say Tordesillas and people pull me up. But anyway, yeah, the treaty there, where the Pope of the time, I think it might have been Alexander, the one they're making the current movie about, the Borgia Pope. He was Spanish, and I think it was him, that one. And they signed this treaty, and in 1493, and gave the lands to between the Vatican families, whoever they are, and the so-called Columbus families. And that's the contract. And that's they always defer back to that. So no matter – so this ownership thing where they tell you you can go and get a plot of land, which they call a lot, an allotment, go and grab that and we'll give you a title and you can own it. Well, it's an illusion because – they really don't give their property up that easy. So they know that from behind the scenes, from on top of the system, they control it all because they have the treaties. They have the contracts, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And the Vatican has the contract that trumps them all, all of them. And that's the Holy See, the Crown and the Commonwealth. These were well-established in the days of Constantine and even further back in the days of the Flavians and even back further in the days of the Julians. So this is a 2,000-year-old thing. Rome is a kingdom of ideas and it's about to fall. And all of the ideas, we're still using them. They are draconian. They are antiquated. They come from an old way of thinking. It's the old order. This is why they keep trying to sell us the New World Order, because what they're trying to do is give us another version of Rome, the Fourth Reich. You see, the First Reich was Rome. The Second Reich was the Holy Roman Empire, which lasted for 1,000 years from Charlemagne to Napoleon's time. And then the Third Reich, well, so-called Third Reich of Hitler, to establish a third, because he went in league with the Vatican. You see, he signed a concordant,
mm-hmm.
concordat with the Vatican, with Pope Pacelli, and at the time, Cardinal Pacelli, of course, and that was the Third Reich. In other words, Rome Mark III. But Rome doesn't go away that easily unless the Vatican is totally dismantled and thrown into the abyss, which it will be. We'll never get rid of this control system and the way it works and everything. It's all Roman. It's a kingdom of ideas, and it's the last great materialistic beast to fall before peace can come on this planet.
Well, I was hopeful that we were in the midst of that when the Pope retired, because that was such an unprecedented move. But, you know, typically I'm very cynical that we'll get over these kind of things, because I just don't see the awakening happening on the level that I feel like it should. But, you know, you've presented some information that you think that this age of awakening is something that it's beyond us. It's something that we are going to go through regardless if we want to or not. There's a mechanism there in the universe that would put us through that time. Is that kind of correct? Is that what you found?
Yes. This is a process. This is the way the universe gets things done. I mean, everything ascends like a distillery, you know, like water.
Mm-hmm.
The sun in the solar system is able to draw the molecules of water and separate them, and is able to cause the water, which is quite heavy, but just the rays, the warm rays of the sun in the atmosphere, pull the water up and cause the clouds. And the philosophers explain that this is how the sun draws souls. The sun, the solar, is not only the chief vital force of the solar system, but it's the chief spiritual force. It's the spirit part of our nature. And it draws the souls, and all souls that have incarnated in this solar system will ascend, except for, of course, so-called evil souls that are willfully destructive and very, very intent on doing harm to others. And this is called the cycle of necessity. We are all on the cycle of necessity. We are all at a different stage of development and growth and evolution spiritually. No one person is the same or at the same level. And that's because we are on the cycle of necessity. And in the scriptures, in particular I think it might be Matthew chapter 16, if I'm not wrong, where it talks about there that an owner of a vineyard, he contracted some workers for one denarii to work for a day, which was to the value of a day's labor. But the beautiful parable, it's a beautiful parable, and it explains how we reincarnate in the cycle of necessity and how we graduate from this cycle as we do the good work. So some are ascending quicker than others, and the only reason we have holy scriptures and holy saint-like people in history is to push that process along, but it's going to happen naturally anyway. All things will be drawn to the Creator, to the light. But the parable is beautiful because it speaks how the owner of the vineyard went into town and contracted other laborers to go out and work in the vineyard. Some started at midday, some started at the third hour of the afternoon, and some started at the last hour to work, and they were all contracted with the same amount of money. So when it came time at the end of the day to pay the workers, the ones that came last that only did an hour of work, they were paid the same money as the ones that were employed from the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And so the ones that were employed in the morning complained to the master and said, "But master, we've been working all day, and then these guys only rocked up an hour ago and they get the same amount of money." And then the master says, "Well, am I doing you an injustice? Didn't we contract for one piece of money at the end of the day, and that's what I'm giving you?" And so this is a beautiful parable which explains that some reincarnate and, you know, perhaps only take a few thousand years to find themselves, to do the good work and reascend, whereas others linger in limbo or purgatory, or call it hell, the lower regions, for a longer time. Celsus, the second century philosopher, in his book Against the Christians, the true logos, the true word, he mentions there that Empedocles spoke about 30,000 years as the average period of the cycle of necessity for each soul to be able to learn their, well, not necessarily learn their lessons, but remember who they are, experience all the things that the Creator wishes to experience through their soul, and then return and ascend. And so being a sovereign, for want of a better word, I'll use sovereign because it still does contain its true essential meaning, the sovereignty movement and the lawful movement. See, people have discovered now that they have been subjected to positive law or man-made law and not natural law. And so they're opening their eyes and beginning to see this and demanding that we return to this beautiful natural way of law. Do no harm. We don't need thousands and thousands of laws have enactments and statutes and bylaws and codes, and people are getting thrown into jail through these codes, you know.
Right. Endless bureaucracy.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
It is, man. Let's back it up a little bit, because of all the lies and cover-ups that we've been victim to, you've said the biggest lie is the Jesus Savior story. And Kyle and I both got stuck going to Catholic school growing up. We realize that this story is bullshit. Realized it pretty early on, but your work is bringing me back around to the idea that rather than Christianity and the Jesus motif just being a mechanism for control, it might also disguise some underlying ancient truth that's been purposely weeded off the planet. Can you walk us through a bit of that lie and how the truth is coded in the Bible and in Christianity?
Yeah, for sure. Look, the Gospels are nothing other than sacred writings based on the workings of light. This is why, you know, the Gospel of John in particular, the first chapter talks about Jesus coming to the world and the light which was from above, and those from below did not recognize that light, etc., etc. And so it's dealing with light. And sometimes Jesus or the Christ takes on the character of the Son. Sometimes it takes on the archetype of the higher consciousness. But all of the characters, every single individual character in the Bible, except for retrospect.
Yeah, stuff they added way later.
Yeah. So, like, for instance, the name of Quirinius, the governor of Syria, the name Pontius Pilate, these occur in history. This was done by the I think the Flavians did that. You see, these are documents that are based on light, but they are slightly mutilated. What happens is gospels are written by philosophers, astronomers, wise men and women who understand that the only gospel there is the one in the stars. You know, the 12 signs of the zodiac are the 12 apostles or the 12 apostles. Notice the word post in apostles. Notice the word disc in disciples. It's all dealing with the disc of the zodiac. And as you begin to look upward and pay attention to the glorious works of the Creator, then you begin to realize that the only gospel there is the gospel of the zodiac. And the Son is the Christ who does his work with his 12 apostles. And so bringing about the seasons and the harvest and the wine and the bread, two symbols of Christianity. And so these gospels, what happens is when Egypt is ruling the world 4,000 years ago, the hero of the gospel is Osiris, and his helpers have their separate respective names, and they go helping that lord, and, you know, He's the one that brings vitality and spirituality and goodness to the people of Egypt. But what happens is then Greece comes along and they also historize their documents. Plutarch, in the first century, the priest of Delphi, he said that there was a certain guy called Ephemeris. And he said, this idiot Ephemeris went around the globe collecting myths and legends and historicizing them and bringing them down to earth and making them literal human heroes. And this is where we get the expression. And Christianity is suffering with this. They have also been deceived. The Roman elite have deceived them. They have created the greatest Ponzi tax collecting scheme in history, because all of the IRS, rest assured, I can prove this. I won't be able to do it in an hour, but I can prove this. The IRS are collecting money for Jesus, rest assured. It's all about Jesus. It's all about the historical Jesus that never came and never will return. It's the literal rendering. You see, even the Bible itself tells you that the letter of the word is putting to death, but the spirit of the word is vivifying. Because people who only understand the scriptures literally suffer with a blindness. It's a spiritual blindness, because there is much, much more to these documents than meets the eye. And mm-hmm. The story that is in there is clear. And it's only clear to people who have ascended their light and done the good work and who can see with the mind's eye. And these people become what are termed and categorized as witches, heretics, astrologers, seers, and they are branded as lunatics. And they are ostracized because they are not belonging to the orthodox way. And a lot of them end up in psychic wards of mental institutions because the powers that be want that. You see, they want these people out of the way, out of sight. And they've been persecuted since Hypatia, even back. You know, we've had these luminaries that have come. Socrates, Seneca, all these were put to death. Boethius, Giordano Bruno, Pico della Mirandola. All of these guys were teaching exactly the same thing as I am. I'm not original at all. You know, I'm just standing on their shoulders, and I feel like an idiot when I speak compared to them, you know. And so because I'm just a baby novice student of the great knowing ones of the past. There's two kinds of philosophers that are idolized in this world. There's thinking ones, you know, these intellectual types with their great theories. They're thinking men, you know, great men of critical thinking, rational men, philosophers. Right. They're basically just idiots, you know, men like Darwin, full of theories, no truth, you know, no real knowledge, because it's based on his senses. All the information he gathered was based on his five senses. And Walter Russell says that this is imperial reductionism. Is that right? I'm just having a bit of a...
I don't know, man.
Well, yeah, what I'm trying to say is that they are gathering their information by what they observe with the senses. It's not knowing.
Right.
You see, so this is one kind of philosopher. They get, you know, Nobel Prizes and awards and all sorts of things. And these philosophers are glorified in the universities today, whereas the true knowing philosophers, your Pythagoras, Orpheus, Plato, these men, you know, we seem to, you know, treat them now in the universities like, oh, yeah, you know, a bit strange kind of people, those people. But, you know, they've got some genius about them. But it's the thinking ones these days that are praised. You know, this is why we have Hegelian dialectic and we have Malthusian schemes, you know, because they get the elites get their teachings from their favorite thinking philosophers.
Absolutely.
Hegel, Darwin and Malthus and these guys, you see, rather than getting them from, you know, the Hermes and the Jesuses, because when you read the Gospels. And by the way, one thing must be said. We know that the words of Jesus are not the writings of Jesus, do we not?
Right.
Well, because nowhere in the Bible does it say this is what Jesus wrote. Whereas Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all say, and Luke in particular says, I gathered this information from hearsay. Those Gospels are all hearsay.
Right.
Luke heard from someone and wrote down the gospel, right? And so this is another way that we can really, really, really truthfully see with our mind's eyes and with our hearts that know all truth, that the Bible is a literary work, because no one's owning up to have written any stuff in there.
Right.
Well, Moses is, but Moses is a different kettle of fish. Here we have the Savior, the one that truly, truly came to save mankind. Supposedly he turned up here for 33 years but didn't write anything.
Right.
Said a lot of stuff. Well, now it's all hearsay. So it's very convenient to do it that way. You know, this is the way you can control it, because then you can twist the words.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, because it's all hearsay.
It does seem that it's an instrumental aspect of the European expansion was always to stamp out the culture of the people they were dominating, and those cultures usually had a more natural view of the world. But I've heard you talk about Jesus as just symbolizing the sun. Is that correct? I mean, our sun, of course.
Our sun, yes, in particular. That's the Savior, the Lord that rises. Look,
right.
every eye shall see him. I shall return the way I departed. Yeah, because when the sun sets, you turn around 12 hours later and there it is rising.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the risen Savior. Why do we have these expressions? Why is the resurrection of Jesus celebrated in March, April, in the sign of the Lamb, Aries? Because it is. It's the Lamb. Jesus is the Lamb. It's the sun. When the sun reaches Aries, it's the Lamb of God. When it reaches Leo, it's the Lion of the tribe of Judah. The scepter shall not depart from that sign. Leo rules the zodiac. It's the hottest month of the year. You know, when it reaches the sign of Aquarius, it's the sun of man.
Huh.
When it reaches the sign of Pisces, it's the fisherman of men. When it reaches Taurus, it's the rock. Taurus has always been known as the rock. When it reaches Gemini, it's the twin. There's many paintings in Byzantine art that depicts Jesus as a twin because it's Gemini. So the sun in Gemini is a twin. Then when Jesus, the sun, reaches Cancer, it's the scarab. And my Lord, the scarab. How many church fathers say Jesus is a scarab? He's a beetle. He is my beetle. He's my holy, holy beetle. Because beetle is the sign that is the scarab is the crab of Cancer. Then when it reaches Virgo, it's the one that serves. Virgo is the sign of service, and so the Pisces Virgo axis of the equinoxes that we've been under for the last 2,000 years, the sun has been in Pisces for 2,000 years, the vernal equinox, and the autumnal equinox, its opposite, has been in Virgo. This has been 2,000 years of Christian, the fisherman, Jesus, Jupiter Zeus, and Virgo, the age of service, the age of belief and doubt, because one fish believes and one fish doubts. And so when the sun arrives at the tropic, at the sign of Libra, it's the just one, the one who's come to judge, because Libra is the sign, the middle of the year. It's the middle of the sine wave. It's the middle, it's the 23rd of September is the other equinox. So it's virtually 180 degrees from Aries, the start. So it's the middle of the circle. And it judges. Then when the sun reaches Scorpio, it becomes the be cautious as doves and wise as serpents, because the dove and the serpent are the two animals of Scorpio. Then when the sun comes into Sagittarius, it is the one who says, I have come to divide the world, because the arrow of Sagittarius on the 21st of December, the solstice, the shortest day of the year, where Sagittarius is pointing with his arrow, that's the dividing mark. That's the solstice.
Huh.
Sagittarius is there at the solstice, pointing to it and waiting for the 21st of December, the solstice, for the sun. And I have come to divide the world. Then when the sun is in Capricorn, it's the carpenter, because the motto of Capricorn is I create, I use. And it's the Masonic symbol, the goat. And so you see, we have the wheel, the, you know, King Arthur and his 12 knights,
right,
of the round table, Jesus and his 12 disc eyeballs. And so when you look at Leonardo da Vinci's Last Supper, you see Jesus is in the middle of 12 disciples, six to his right, six to his left. They are grouped further into groups of three. So on Jesus's left, on your left as you look at the Last Supper, you see Aries to the left with his hands on the table at the head of the table. No other disciple is at the head of the table. All the other 11 are behind the table because Aries is the head. It's in the head of the human organism. Pisces is at the feet, the 2 feet. So if you follow Leonardo from Aries from the left, you will see that he has thrown in some ciphers, very conveniently, for the ones with eyes to see, of course. And you will notice every single individual apostle from the left to the right, from Aries to Pisces, you will see secret hand positions that indicate that Leonardo da Vinci knew who the disciples were.
Wow.
Aries, Taurus, Gemini. In fact, when you get to the third, you can do this right now. You can Google the Last Supper and go to images, and you look at the third disciple from the left, and you'll see that he's sitting there with his two hands in front of his face, almost obscuring his face. Yes, well, because the two twins, Gemini, the third sign is Gemini. It rules the arms and the hands, the shoulders, and the two lungs.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. That's pretty interesting. He's got both his hands up, palms up.
And to Jesus' left, you will see a green Venetian ruler of Libra with her arms outstretched. Why is that very effeminate-looking apostle stretching out his arms? Is he yawning? Is he tired? Or is she? Because it's Venus. And to Jesus' right is Virgo, and Cancer is pointing to the Adam's apple, showing that there is no Adam's apple in this disciple. It must be a woman. Well, it is. It's the Virgin. And so these knowing ones, Leonardo was not a thinking philosopher. No. He was a knowing one. He knew the science, and he was conveying that through his art to the world, leaving them a message saying one day when the Enlightenment comes in 500 or 600 years, when Saturn returns in the age of Aquarius and Uranus, you will understand this picture and you will know where I'm coming from. You will know that I knew the science of all sciences called the perennial philosophy.
That's fascinating stuff, man.
Yeah.
That definitely painted a little bit of a picture for me. One other thing I really wanted to get to, it's probably a slightly lengthy topic, so we should probably try to get it in. The ascension story and the whole ascension into heaven story is an analogy for human enlightenment. How does this relate to the pineal gland?
Yeah, well, in the Bible, the pineal gland is called Penuel, and that's the place that Jacob, the place where he saw God face to face, and he called that place Penuel, which is, you know, just a play on the word pineal. It's the pineal gland.
Mm-hmm.
Because Jacob, when he ascended the ladder, he had a dream. He placed his head on a stone. That's the stone of Scone, or the sacrum, which is the second most bottom portion of the spinal column, the vertebrae, the 33 vertebrae. There are 5 bones that are fused just above the coccyx, which are composed of 4 fused bones, and this is the sacrum. This is called the sacred part of the spinal column, and this is where Jacob lays his head, and then he sees a ladder, which is the spinal column, and he sees angels descending and ascending, and he ascends the ladder. He struggles with an angel, gets a name changed to Israel. And then he says, I've seen God face to face, and he declares the name, because he has lived and not died, he declares the name Pineal. And so what this is secretly talking about in the esoteric understanding of the scriptures is that we are ascending the beautiful oil, which is called in... if you look at Sontay's anatomy or Gray's anatomy, it will be called chrism, the fluid in the cerebrospinal system, which is produced in the claustrum, in the cerebellum, in the cerebrum. This oil descends down to the sacrum and then ascends through the spinal system, the cerebrospinal system, returns to the optic thalamus at the top of the medulla oblongata, and this is the chamber. This is called the chamber, you see.
Mm-hmm.
This is, this is, for instance, the initiation chamber, the third ventricle in Sontay's anatomy. The third ventricle is the cave of Brahma, and this is where, once the oil ascends, the pineal gland is there, see, at one end of the optic thalamus, and at the other end is the pituitary gland. So when the oil ascends and reaches these glands, electric energy arcs in the pineal gland, and this electric energy is sent through the foramen in the fornix. There's a special little place in the midbrain, and it's called the fornix.
Mm-hmm.
Once this electrical arcing reaches the fornix, this is illumination. The pineal gland produces a new secretion, which is called the blood of the Christ, which saves. And this balances the blood, the chemical composition of the blood, and restores the health of the individual, and activates the dormant brain cells in the cerebrum, And this is the resurrection. The dead, this is what is called the resurrection of the dead. The dead shall rise, because the dead refers to the spiritually dead. No one is saved, quote unquote, unless they have restored themselves to their higher processes, to their higher state, and remembered who they are.
And is there a way we can work on that on an individual level?
Meditation and entheogens would be sort of more of synthetic, you know, way of doing that. But entheogens are certainly admissible.
I actually just had my first DMT experience not more than 10 days ago.
Yeah, well, it's an artificial way of inducing the whole experience of ascending the consciousness. But certainly, you know, do not neglect your meditation. And yes, restore yourself to your higher mind by going within. And once, you know, the light is restored, you become clairvoyant. You don't become so much a medium of this information. You become a clairvoyant and you know this information. You have direct access to this information. And you have downloads. You know, you have downloads of understanding. And so, and what you do is you shed your lower perspective of seeing the world. You know, I mean, you can't, for instance, when you get in an aeroplane, how many things have been discovered by traveling in aeroplanes? All those pyramids in Mesoamerica were discovered. The Nazca lines in Peru were discovered by raising the perspective. There are things on the ground that you just don't see. This is why the pineal gland must be reached, because along the cerebrospinal system there are seven plexuses or nerve ganglions, and these are called chakras in the Eastern system, and these correspond to the seven levels of consciousness. And if we are seeing things from the bottom chakra, our perspective is different from at the elevated higher consciousness of the pineal area and the crown chakra. So this is why we need to ascend the oil, and we need to be ascended and raise our perspective. Then we see things more clearly. We see that the anthropomorphic Jesus in the Bible is not a literal character. It does not find its place anywhere in history. It's a literary character and finds its place in our hearts. This is why Jesus never did write anything. He is the inspiration of the Gospels. We are creators. We have the creating faculty, and so has the solar system. Therefore, this is what we call God. This is what we call Jesus, the Savior. Our solar system, because it is the local part of God, the creator, the cause, which loves us and nurtures us. And so we love it, because we have only love for God's creation. And the stars above are creators, and we love them. And does not Job, the book of the Bible, talk about the morning stars, how they rejoiced and they applauded the creation, the physical creation of God?
Yeah.
Because the morning stars are the suns. It's talking about the suns. They are the creators. The light, the electrical vibration that emanates from their magnetic centers create forms. And we see those forms, and we congratulate those forms. They are beautiful. Man loves to see the curves of the beautiful opposite-sexed female. And the female loves to see the virulence and the magnificence of the masculine virility, you know, the masculine fire body. And they meet together, and they have sex, and they make love, and they enter the higher consciousness, depending on how they practice their sex. If they are what's considered to be fornicators and adulterers, you know, they will just indulge in lower bestial type of sex. But if they have affection and love and are more principled in their love, they will, rather than practicing, you know, earthy type animalistic sex, they will practice divine sex. And they will raise the vibration and the oil of the chrism of Christ up the kundalini from a fucus in Scorpio, one of the deacons of Scorpio in the generative system, up to the optic thalamus, which is Orion. So a fucus, one, when we practice sex, we are stimulating the serpents of a fucus, the kundalini and the kundabatha. Mm-hmm. And we are raising the energy and the oil up the spine, because the cerebrospinal fluid is really a gas, really. It's the fish, it's the oil, it's the manna, it's the soma, it's the good oil, it's the bread. I am the bread of life. Bread. And so as we ascend it and we practice more divine sex in the head, we raise the vibration of our sexual practices, then we have orgasms in the head rather than in the testes, which is discharging the electric and magnetic forces of the organism. I'm not condemning this, and no one condemns this, but it's just a different orgasm. Mm-hmm. And so the ones that practice more sort of a tantric sex and raise the energy, they have what's called a pneumatic or a spiritual orgasm, which is an orgasm in the mind. And these are far more sustained than the physical orgasm. The physical orgasm is fleeting. But here one is able to experience their own blissful, godlike nature. This is why animals and human beings that have physical orgasms rather than spiritual orgasms desire to have the orgasm, because they want to know and experience their true, true nature and get in touch with it. But the philosopher, he or she declines from having this type of orgasm and seeks the one beyond the physical, which is more emotional than spiritual than mystical. There's four levels. There's the physical orgasm, there's the emotional, there's the spiritual, and the mystical. And they have to do with earth, water, air, and fire. And so when you realize and understand this science, you begin to free yourself. You'll know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Churchgoers are bound. This is what church means. A religion, rilegare, is one derivative of religion. The other one, it would be to reveal the doctrines of truth. And mm-hmm. so there's always a spiritual and a physical nature to religion. And this is why people hate religion, because they see it as a physical thing, a mechanism, and they see religions, which are just corporations.
Yes.
They can't be anything but corporations, because there is, Christ is and always will be the Christ within. Colossians 1:26 and 27. Only the ignorant ones, according to the Apostle Paul, do not know this sacred secret. And hence are awaiting for an external savior. The Christ is the process of the chrism and ascending the oil and the consciousness within. One saves oneself within. And this is why Christ is known as the Savior.
You talk about these energies rising, it reminds me a lot of the coiled serpent energy and this connection with the serpent and also with sex and the feminine. I think with Christianity in particular, their origin story in Genesis, the scene with Adam and Eve and the serpent and Yahweh and the tree of life, I think it is meant in a certain way to diminish the feminine, to diminish sex, and then they instill with their morals all this shame about sex. So it seems like there's an intentional effort to move us away from this.
Only from the controlling elite. The intent is not in the scriptures themselves. These are literary, beautiful truths, and their beauty has been
bastardized.
Exactly, beautiful word. There you go. And that has been done intentionally by the pedophile elite, who want nothing more than to control people through all these corporate religions. They are all fictional. They all only exist in the imaginations of the duped that go to these churches, and there are, I believe, now 30,000 registered Christian, so-called Christian denominations. All of them are false. They're all condemning each other, and they're all telling you, if you listen, that they're all going to hell, because that's what... the Mormons are saying that the Seventh-day Adventists will do, and the Seventh-day Adventists are telling you that the Pentecostals will, and so they all will. And so what we have is, you know, a system of great, great deception, and who does it serve? It serves the controlling elite. And what for? What is this the world they want? Is this the world they want where they have to, invade other countries with their partners, and they perform operations. Libya was 2 years ago when they decided to go into Libya to kill Colonel Gaddafi. That was an operation, right. And Hillary Clinton was selling that as our partners. These are corporate crimes. You see, these days, these corporations, these partners, they get together and they go around invading other countries to steal their oil and to steal their freedoms and to install central Rothschild-run, Rockefeller-run, Vatican Jesuit-run central banks.
Right.
And whoever doesn't comply falls. And so there's murder and bloodshed in country after another. Look at Argentina in the 70s and Chile in the 70s. Look at Indonesia and, look at Vietnam. Look at Korea.
Yeah.
Look at...
time and time again.
Yeah, Iraq and Afghanistan. And this is just corporate bloodshed. Is this the world that they want? Do they want to be the rulers of shit? Because that's it. They've got. They are. Yes, they're the rulers. Oh well, they must congratulate themselves and feel very proud of themselves when they go to their Bilderberg meetings. And you know, there's Kissinger at one table, and and there's the other imbecile. What's his name? The other idiot who founded the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. And they would be congratulating these types, the Kissinger types, they'd be congratulating themselves at the Bilderbergs for being the controllers of all of this, you know, in their think tanks, in their meetings when they get together to control, to be the controllers of all this shit. So, you know, congratulations. They get, Barack Obama gets a Nobel Prize for being, you know, one of the powerful boys of ruling all of this world of shit. You know, there's right. security cameras everywhere. You know, before you board a plane these days, you've got to go through full body scanners. They want to put their fingers up your bum to see if you've got some sort of a cracker or some dynamite up there. They want to feel what's in your pants. They want to control everything. Well, this system now is we're tired of this, and even the elites are tired of this now, and there's many of them defecting and wishing for a better world. Why would you want to be – why would you disempower the world so that they distrust you and hate banksters and hate, the controlling elite? Wouldn't you want to be loved? Wouldn't you – why don't they just let go of this controlling system and the pedophilia and the people trafficking, the guns traffic and everything, because it's a world that's just full of turmoil and trauma, and they get to be called the bosses of it. Well,
right.
Guess what? They're going to be pushed aside, and a new consciousness is going to take over, and that will be one where of self-determination, number one, of knowing thyself, knowing ourselves, number two, of tolerance, forbearance, love, generosity. You know, to have a currency, not a fictional currency where a ruling elite derive financial benefit by just loading interest onto
it.
Right. We can have a currency of love. I can say to you, brother, you know what? I'll do an hour on your show. How's that? And, you know, I'll do that on Thursday when Thursday turns up, and I'll stick to my word.
True.
And that's pretty good currency.
Yeah.
People benefit from that. I do. I've benefited from it. And so, you know, you rock up, you've got a sack of potatoes and you give it to your pumpkin farmer down the road. And, you know, there's only abundance. There's no shortages. You know, the Bilderbergers and the trilateralists and the Council on Foreign Relations, the UN, these are all criminal corporations that are just giving you services other than the abundance that is already there. They are there to tell you that there's shortages.
Yes.
They
work hard.
To tell you, yeah, they're working hard to tell you that, and they'll give you science, false science, to back it up. And they'll say, there's a shortage of air, so you got to pay carbon tax. There's a shortage of fossil fuel, so you got to pay $3 a gallon at the tap. Everything's short, and yet I don't see shortages. I see abundance everywhere.
I think a lot of people are starting to realize that the scarcity is a bit of an illusion, and especially with things like 3D printers. I mean, 3D printers, if they can print any normal object, that right there, it's like, how do you charge for that when you're able to create infinite amounts of spatulas and plates and whatever you need?
Everything is there for our taking. It's there. This is why the original sanction and blessing to humanity is everything. There's many trees in the garden that I've planted. Eat to satisfaction. And that what that means is there is abundance everywhere. Multiply yourselves is the blessing from the universe, the universe of light. And not to restrict, not to limit, not to have limitations and shortages. There's no restrictions. And so governments are there to restrict. And so we need to really deal with this fictional invention and these Ponzi schemes, the whole lot, lock, stock and barrel. You know, as I said before, you can go back to Constantine's family when Constantine, late in the 4th century, they discovered what was called the donation of Constantine. Look it up. The donation of Constantine is Peter's pence. This is where they get their ecclesiastical authority to go around charging taxes through the IRS and the ATO and all of these criminal organizations. It's Peter's pence. It's nothing other than Peter's pence. Rest assured and know this one universal truth. You owe no money to anybody. There is no organization that exists, because they don't exist. They're corporations, they're corpses. They have no existence outside of paper, and they cannot receive anything through not having any existence. And therefore, we are free, you see. Mm-hmm. We are free to keep all of our resources and energy and currency to ourselves.
Absolutely.
So, do not communicate with these illegal bloodshedding entities called governments. You know, they are another creature. They are separate to us, and they are rapidly descending into the abyss with all their fictions with them. So learn, know who you are, and know that, that we are all that is, all that was, and all that ever will be. And so it's time to kiss goodbye the Roman fictions that have been invented and still being perpetuated by the Roman elite. Because after all, that's what they are. Look at all the presidents of the United States. They're all one big family of cousins.
Right,
like
yeah.
Obama's related to, you know,
Cheney.
Bush. And yeah, they're all related. And Bush declares, they tell you that they come from these, from the Stuarts, from the Windsors, from the Plantagenets, from the, you know, the Tudors. And they tell you. And these families are the controlling elite. And they are inbred pedophile, people trafficking, pirate families who are behind all of the crime, all of the terrorism and vandalism of the earth. And we need to deal with them. So there you go, brother.
Well said, man. We've gone a little long. I don't want to take up any more of your time. I mean, I do appreciate, I feel like I can see through the corruption, the manipulation. We do that on our own show a lot. But I'm a bit spiritually retarded or constipated, for a little better term. But, you know, a lot of teachers and leaders and guests that I've had say that this is where the road leads to, you know, there's no sense in uncovering the lies if you're not willing to deal with the truth. And, you know, you've had some eye-opening revelations during this conversation. I really appreciate it, man. If there's anything else you want to point out to the people, let them know what your website is. Once again, is there anything else you're working on?
For the UK listeners, I'll be doing 9 engagements all through the UK, starting in the north near Scotland, going all the way down to Glastonbury. So that'll be all of August. So check out my website, universaltruthschool.com, for the UK listeners. Also, I'll be going to Italy before that. At the end of July, I'll do 4 days in Florence, 4 days of presenting sovereignty, syncretism, the science of light, astrology, astrotheology. And then in September, Holland and Italy. So if anyone wants to catch that, that's what's new in the syncretism world for me.
All right. Well, there you have it, people. Thanks again for being with us, Santos. Enjoy the rest of your evening.
Thank you, brother. Take
care. All right. Keep fighting the good fight.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Wow, man. Okay. Kyle, how was that? I know you're more into the esoteric and mystic than I am at this stage of the game. But was there anything there that resonated with you?
It was a lot of information to take in, and a lot of the kind of like systems of things he was talking about in this conversation, I had never heard of them put quite that way, such as like Aries is the head and Gemini the lungs. I mean, I can see connections, but it's almost a whole different language than what I'm used to.
Yeah, and I guess I don't understand what that should mean to me. You know, like, what does that do for my life? What is the understanding of that? Because we talk, there is definitely an architecture that's been created of birth certificates and regulations, and they talk about maritime law and the court system. It's this big structure, this false reality, and it's created to enslave and control, but at the same time, also to distract. And to distract from what? And that's supposed to be the true knowledge, the underlying knowledge, the stuff that Santos was talking about. It's definitely dense and heavy to take in, especially to someone who's been indoctrinated for 20 years and is just completely off the reservation as far as this material is concerned. But it's still worth looking into, because clearly a lot of effort was put into denying us this information. And there must be a reason there. So there must be a practical application to our lives. There must be some enriching element that it is just not reached me in my life. But there must be something there, because otherwise there'd be no reason to veil it, to hide it so well, put so much energy into it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and it's interesting, the idea of like going back and reading sacred texts such as the Bible. I mean, Santos said in this conversation that it's for those with eyes that can see. And it's made me, I mean, I've become very interested in the Tao Te Ching and also the Bhagavad Gita and all kinds of different religions, and trying to figure out what they're all talking about, because they're all talking about the same thing. They're talking about the human condition. They're talking about things making astrological events relatable to the actual human experience. That's, you got to bridge the gap there. That's what I find most interesting.
Right.
That's when the meaning like really pops out, is when you're like, oh, okay, I get it. And yeah. One thing I wanted to get into, I'll bring it up now because we got some time, but in this particular Garden of Eden myth, the characters and the whole scene is set up like this. Okay, there's the Tree of Life. They're in the garden. Adam and Eve. There's the serpent, and then there's Yahweh. And Yahweh, you know, tells them, hey, don't eat from this tree. And he goes off, and the serpent tells Eve, you know, you can't eat from that tree. He's just full of shit. And so it's about how you – and then, okay, so Yahweh comes back to finish off the story. He comes back. Where did he go? He was gone. He comes back to the scene, and he's like, holy shit, you ate the fruit. And now you're, you know, punished because you didn't follow my rules. So there's different interpretations here. The Gnostics would say that the serpent is actually the good guy here. The serpent is the deity that already was there. The serpent is from the garden.
Mm-hmm.
Yahweh came to the garden. So came to, where did he come from? How come he left and then he comes back to find Eve there? It's like he is, it's kind of like he was stranded and now he crash lands on Earth and now he puts himself in charge. Unlike the serpent, which is much more representative of, you know, moving up the spinal cord, that the spinal cord, the Kundalini energy, life and shedding skin from death into rebirth and everything having to do with the divine feminine and the goddess spirituality. That's what was already there. And then this other god came and crash landed and basically said, you got to follow my rules. If you don't follow my rules, then you are going to be fucking punished. Whereas the other more goddess religion said to humanity, you know, you can basically do what you want. This is a garden. Don't listen to that guy. So the oldest game in the book is this whole thing about spirituality where, oh, if you want to talk to God, well, you got to go through me because I'm the official channel.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, I am the high priest. And this same thing translates into academia where if you want to go to somebody who's a counselor, they have to be accredited and they have to go through this whole process to prove that they're worthy of a counselor.
It is messed up, man. You kind of started cutting out, but it is messed up. And when a man says something to me like, well, it's there for people who have eyes to see, I'm just like, well, that's extremely condescending and doesn't really give me any information, doesn't really tell me anything. It's some kind of in line with the Alan Watts thing where he describes Zen Buddhism and he's like, you know, people come to a master because they want enlightenment and the master knows that, you know, you have enlightenment, you already have it from the day you're born. And if you want to go through all these trials to remember that, then that's your thing, man. That's, you're able to do that. But you really don't need to do that. You can just come to the realization of yourself. And again, that is also doesn't really give me much information. But I guess that's the struggle that all those people are going through. All the people who are going to the Buddhist monastery for guidance, you don't need it. I guess that's the big cosmic joke, is you don't need any guidance.
I guess that is the big cosmic joke.
I don't know, man. But hey, I'm going to let you go. I know your time, it's getting awfully late. The sun might even be about to rise, which I don't know what that means. I guess it's, you know, the sun is the savior and all that stuff.
Yeah, Horus is about to overcome Set.
Yeah, so, well, as always, man, thanks for doing the show with me. I want to remind people that reviewing the show and rating the show, sharing the show really helps out. Also, purchases at conspiracies.net and donations at thehighersidechess.com do as well. Check out Mind Comics if you like a little conspiracy mixed into your entertainment. It's a fun little company. It's pretty awesome. So, also, if you're going to be in San Diego for Comic-Con or in the area, my buddy Ron from Paranoia Magazine is having the first ParanoiaCon event where Olav Phillips will be talking about Nazi space bases. Adam Gorightly will be talking about something probably Discordianism related. I'll be hanging out there as well. Just Google ParanoiaCon to get some tickets. Keep feeding the alternative culture because, you know, Sony and Universal and Marvel, they're doing just fine. So I think they could do without a few Comic-Conners, and Ron could definitely appreciate the extra tickets. So thanks again for every minute of your time. You're all amazing, and you're all God's children or something like that. So I'll see you next week. Peace. Painted up.